I'm very happy now to welcome Kathy Christensen. She's a former political analyst for the CIA. She's author of 3 books on Palestine, including Perceptions of Palestine and The Wound of Dispossession. She recently returned from Gaza and the West Bank, and she will be speaking tomorrow at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. That's Friday at 7 o'clock in the evening. The event is a fundraiser for MECCA, the Middle East Children's Alliance, and it's sponsored by Santa Feans for Justice in Palestine, Israel. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
So what is the significance of May 15th, Nakba Day?
The Nakba is the Palestinian Arabic word for catastrophe, and it marks the event in 1948 when the Palestinians were basically dispossessed from their homeland because of the creation of Israel, of the state of Israel. At this time in 48, over a period of several months, something like two-thirds of the population of Palestine, the Arab population of Palestine, was dispossessed, expelled, and not allowed to return. That's about 750,000 people. They went to refugee camps in the West Bank, which was then not a part of, for the next 19 years, was not a part of Israel. It was controlled by Jordan in those years. Then Jordan lost that territory, the West Bank, in 1967. But most of the refugees, I think the largest portion of refugees went to Lebanon in those years, 48, 49. And that is the largest refugee population at the moment. I think it's something like, still living in refugee camps, something like 400,000, maybe even more. There are refugees in Syria who have been there since 1948, and they have their major camp, the Yarmouk camp, right outside Damascus, has come under attack in all the fighting in Syria these days. Huge numbers went to Jordan also, and in Jordan they were made citizens, but many of them still live in refugee camps. So
it's amazing. I mean, when you have generations of people living in refugee camps, that there aren't opportunities for people to return either to where they came from or assimilate into a new society. I mean, we in the United States are so used to absorbing one immigrant wave after another.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, they would like the official Palestinian policy is the right of return, the return to their original homes, which of course are now in Israel, in Israel proper, inside the so-called Green Line, which marks the border between Israel before 1967 and the West Bank and Gaza. But Israel won't allow them to return because, of course, this would, from Israel's standpoint, and from any standpoint, would undermine the Jewish character of Israel, which is wants to exist as a Jewish state, which you obviously cannot do with a majority of non-Jews. Had Israel not, had these Palestinians not fled and been expelled in 1948, the state of Israel, the so-called Jewish state, would have had a majority of non-Jews, that is, Palestinian Arabs. And the Palestinians themselves and the countries they live in the refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, have not wanted to assimilate. Many have come, for instance, to the United States or to Latin America, moved to Europe, moved out of the refugee camps. But the vast majority who are too poor to do that don't want to assimilate into those societies because they want to keep alive the memory of their own homes and their own land.
And eventually, if possible, return.
If possible, yeah, exactly.
So you were recently in Gaza and the West Bank. Where were you? Why did you go? What did you see?
I went with a group of Episcopalians from around the country, small group, only 8 of us, two of us from Santa Fe, another woman, by the way, named Catherine Wilmot, who will also participate in this talk on Friday, tomorrow. And the other 6, we had one Jewish woman who was the friend of the leader of our group, who is a professor in San Antonio. And she had never been there, and she wanted to come. The other 7 of us, all 7 of our 8, were active Episcopalians, members of our churches. One woman from Massachusetts, a couple from Texas, 2 of us from New Mexico, a couple from Oregon, and 1 from California. And the object of our almost everybody, six of us, had been there many times before, was to update ourselves on the situation so that we could sort of be witnesses and educators for our individual congregations. So we concentrated on seeing, not exclusively, but to a great extent, on seeing organizations, sort of self-help Palestinian organizations, that were had been sponsored by the Episcopal Church in Jerusalem, which covers, whose diocese covers Gaza also, and other Palestinian self-help groups. We, for instance, visited a school, kindergarten, for 4 and 5 year olds, sponsored by Kinder, which is a United States-based organization designed at the moment to give Palestinians, who are, many of whom are Palestinian kids, many of whom are still homeless after the war last summer, hot meals every day. And we actually watched these little kids being served meals, which was very heartwarming. It was sort of a grassroots tour to see what the grassroots were doing. We also had a tour from Jeff Halper, who's a recognized expert Israeli-American.
Wonderful speaker. He's been on this show before.
Indeed, yeah.
And big-hearted person.
Big-hearted, indeed, yeah. He's a wonderful guy and a good friend of mine and of several of us on the trip. He took us on a tour of the settlements primarily in East Jerusalem, that is Israeli settlements that have been built in Palestinian neighborhoods. And I had been there.
What was that like?
It was, most of us had seen these before. It was quite, the Jewish woman who, and the Catherine from here, had never seen these before. And I think they were both sort of overwhelmed because the building is so extensive and the expansion is so extensive. I hadn't been there for 5.5 years. And so on the surface, things look pretty much the same. But if you look carefully, you can see that the Israeli settlements have expanded into Palestinian networks, neighborhoods, and it is just, it's really oppressive just to look at it. And we visited a Palestinian neighborhood called Silwan, just at the base of the wall of the old city, which is in which Jewish settlers from Israel are gradually taking over, just seizing individual Palestinian homes.
Like, and without any process, just,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
You, like, it'd be like if somebody showed up in my house and said, take whatever stuff you can carry.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm moving
in. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and the rage that must be engendered by that.
Yeah.
I know it.
That's the exact kind of rage that results in rocket attacks from Gaza. And fortunately, there are no terrorist attacks in this era right at the moment, but there have been in past years, obviously. That's where that rage comes from the Israelis seizing homes.
Now, you have been studying this, and we talk about May 15th as Nakba Day, the catastrophe, but it's really been an unfolding catastrophe for one generation after another. And you have been studying this since the 1960s, a good 50 years. What are you seeing? I mean, you have, as an expert, you have an overview that most of us don't have. Like, do you see any sense of hope?
Not much. You know, we asked a lot of Palestinians if they had any hope, Bill, my husband, and my late husband and I asked this of Palestinians years ago, and they would say, and they told us this time, if we don't have hope, we can't survive. But they don't have optimism, and I don't have any optimism, and I'm afraid I don't have much hope, because the impression I got from this, after not seeing, never having been to Gaza except for 2 hours, which hardly counts, years ago, and not having seen the West Bank and Jerusalem for almost 6 years, is the utter futility of trying to get any kind of change. There is huge change in popular opinion here in the United States at the grassroots level, but not at the policy level or the elite level. And what I saw was Israel just continuing to, as I was saying, build more settlements. And they don't so much build more settlements, but they just expand the existing settlements, take over more and more Palestinian land. And Gaza is just a horrific situation. I mean, there's been no rebuilding. Huge, massive destruction in last summer.
So you basically walked down rubble-covered streets?
Yeah, we did. Unfortunately, we drove past too much of it because we were, you know, we only had a couple of days there and many things to do. But yes, we could. We did get out occasionally and walk down rubble-covered streets where the Palestinians have been able to, or have at least had the bulldozers to clear a pathways, you know, little roads wide enough for a car to drive through, but on either side, like a city block, and for whole city blocks, there is nothing but destruction. You know, buildings that are this not very high because they've all been collapsed, just cement rubble. And you were asking about hope, and the impression I got on this trip is that at least for now, I think the Palestinians feel a sense of utter futility. Because, you know, in 1948, the Palestinians were fighting probably not hard enough because they lived in shock, I think, for several years, a couple of decades after the Nakba. But their goal was the right of return, to come back to their homes and restore life as it had been. Then after 1967, when Israel captured the West Bank, more people in the international community became interested in their plight. And now all focus, to the extent that there is any focus, is on ending the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank particularly, and that's what the so-called peace process was all about. But what I saw now was all the Palestinians can do at the moment, and all I think we from outside can help them do, is to survive as individuals. There's not really a question anymore, because their societies are being destroyed physically, particularly in Gaza, physically because the land is being taken in the West Bank and Jerusalem. What we saw in Gaza, for instance, is helping little children get a hot meal every day. And that's really all that can be done. And I've seen a kind of resignation and a little bit, this is a little bit contradictory, we found, and I was really surprised at how very friendly and seemingly cheerful Gazans were. You know, we'd walk on the street and people would say welcome and so on. If I were a Gazan, I would not welcome an American.
I mean, what is
to
that?
My country? I don't know. It's an amazing kind of resilience.
Is it like generations of shock and survival?
I think so, and it's the knowledge, I guess, that there's nothing else they can do.
I have noticed that almost everybody in the world, except for Americans, is able to distinguish between people and their government.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to countries where America is not, with the, you know, the United States government is not held in a friendly view, they still welcome you.
Yeah,
we Americans
true.
Tend
yeah.
not to do that as much.
I know. I think that's what it was in Gaza. I mean, they're friendly people, and I think they realize that anybody who visits Gaza is there to try to help, or at least is sympathetic. So that's something. But that was really very, it's very heartening to see the efforts that they've been making. You know, there's the same Kinder organization is trying to help poor families, most of whom were poor even before their homes were destroyed, raise chickens for some kind of income. We visited a couple of homes where this is being done, and the mother of this, yet very young mother of this one household was, this project is just coming to be, so she doesn't have the chickens yet. She was very depressed. She actually took the leader, the Palestinian woman who was the leader of the Kinder group that took us, grabbed her by the hand and took her to her refrigerator to show her that it was empty. But it's very heartening in situations like that to see that there is an effort to try to, you know, get this particular woman some help. But my God, there are 1.8 million people in Gaza, in an area that is one-tenth the size of Rhode Island. And you know, helping even before last summer's war was so... so very hard. And since this last war, war is probably not the right term, assault by Israel, the international community had a conference and pledged something like $5 billion of aid, and none of it has come in.
There's a saying, Israel destroys, Europe rebuilds.
Aha, interesting. I hadn't heard that, but that seems to be the case. Yeah. And the U.S. rebuilds. You know, we've given a lot of money to the Palestinians. for rebuilding. I remember when Bill and I first started going to the West Bank in this, you know, about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, the Israeli tanks, this was particularly after an assault into the West Bank in 2002, Israeli tanks would rip up the roads just because that's what tanks do, and they drive on the little asphalt roads. And the USAID would come in and rebuild the roads, which is an absurdity. So
the whole thing is an absurdity, and the fact that you're not very optimistic about it, nobody else is either. Yet, at the same time, there are still, I mean, movements happening on college campuses.
Yeah.
Europe is kind of, I think, further along in the process of understanding the horror of this than the United States on a governmental level. There's a divestment, boycott, and sanctions mm-hmm. movement. And yet, Netanyahu is elected, who has been the power behind these assaults. What did people say about him when you were there?
We didn't actually talk very much. I think the Palestinians were not surprised that he had been elected and that he was in the process when we were there and has just done it of forming an even more right-wing government than he is personally. I think they think that's not a huge change and not unexpected. There really is, I think, a huge change in this country and even more so in Israel. I was just reading before coming on here an article, an interview with Ilan Pappé, who is a marvelous Israeli historian, very honest and a very nice person in addition. He has exiled himself from Israel because his views are so much out of the mainstream, and he has such sympathy and understanding of the Palestinian position. But he is a very honest historian. And he was talking about this very issue, that there is great movement at the grassroots level here in the United States and more in Europe, but it does not reach to the elite level, which includes the media and includes, obviously, the two governments in the case of, well, maybe all the governments in Europe and, of course, the United States. And a lot of that is because of the influence of this so-called Israeli lobby and of the military-industrial complex, which bases its existence on selling arms. And obviously, Israel's assaults on Gaza are something that they support, and the Israeli lobby is really locked. Congress is locked in by the Israel lobby. I think AIPAC, and who really can influence policy and can threaten the the terms of U.S. congressmen.
Kathy Christensen is former political analyst for the CIA, author of several books on Palestine, and she will be speaking tomorrow, Friday the 15th of May at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. It's a fundraiser for the Middle East Children's Alliance. And also, I want to let people know that at noon on the plaza here in Santa Fe, there will be a drum performance by Palestinian-American percussionist Issa Malouf and Percussion Ensemble. And there will also be a message from Gazan lifelong resident Ayman Nijin. So that's all tomorrow at the plaza at noon and then at Tipton Hall at 7 in the evening. For more information, you can call 505-469-0714. You can also look on Facebook for Santa Feans for Justice in Palestine, Israel. Kathy Christensen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.